the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is John Barber. That was Syreeta singing Sunny as Only She Can. And that was Frank Sinatra saying, here's Johnny, the nightly host of The Tonight Show, and had me on. You heard Frank mention that I was a critic in Los Angeles. Well, for over the dozen years that I did that, first as the film critic for 10 years at Los Angeles Magazine, and 5 years, Tom Snyder's sidekick on the 6 o'clock news at NBC. For all of those years, every year, a half a dozen times a year, because there were a half a dozen of them, I always said that the entertainment capital of the world was absolutely incapable of ever putting on an entertaining award show. So I stopped watching them. I did not watch the Emmy show last night. One of the reasons I didn't watch the Emmy show was that I am a huge fan of wit and intelligence. So that was another reason I didn't watch the show. But thank goodness I have some of the wittiest, most intelligent, most articulate friends on Facebook. And one of them is a fellow named Michael Gregory. He's a guitar player. And then another fellow, his name is Nathan Anthony. Every day, each one of these guys and a few others post really funny stuff. So I did not bother watching the Emmy, but evidently Nathan Anthony did. And he said this: the Emmys forgot Barbara Hill, Ron Glass, Dick Gregory, and Aaron Moran died. The Emmys also forgot to get live viewers. We are live on John Barber's World from Las Vegas, Nevada. Folks, I never, ever like to talk about something with which I'm not familiar, but tonight for a while I will. Which means for a while we're going to talk about money. I know and have known a number of extremely rich people. Their unspent money gathers a lot of interest, especially from women and their children. Contrary to popular opinion, folks, money is not the root of all evil. The people who have it are. And I must tell you, the very, very rich people I know, or those I observe in America, truly feel that property is much more important than people. They justify this by pointing out that God created Eden long before he kicked Adam and Eve out for not paying the rent. Do you realize that throughout recorded history, almost everything under the sun has changed and been looked at differently? For over 5,000 years, thoughts about the flat earth, thoughts about the number of gods, thoughts about science, the universe, literature, music, and even religion. The only unchanging thought is about money. Christ threw the money changers out of the temple and the money owners tacked them to a cross. Now, 43 years before Jesus, the Roman philosopher Ovid said this about money, which is just as topical today. Ovid said, quote, "Than cash in hand." Ovid said, "How little you know about the age you live in, if you think honey is sweeter than cash in hand." What got Martin Luther King killed was not his fight for integration, but organizing a poor person's march in Washington, D.C. to talk about a fairer redistribution of wealth. And the money owners said, over your dead body. And the FBI got him a room booked at the Lorraine Motel. Getting rich in America now means working harder and harder at two jobs, hoping to save enough money to buy a lucky Powerball ticket. But it wasn't always that way. Right now, we are lucky to have no one better to explain how and why and who was and is responsible for putting us on this dead-end street to perpetual debt than the author of an immensely readable, enlightening, informative book called Survival of the Richest, the author, Donald Jeffries. Donald, welcome to the show and congratulations on a really, really interesting book.
Well, thanks so much, John. It's great to be here.
As I mentioned to you just before we went on the air, it's always my first question to everyone, those that I like and admire and respect. I always wonder how they got to be the people I like, admire, respect. Tell us just briefly a little bit about where you were born, what your parents are like. Did you have siblings? What did you want to do as a kid? Did you ever think you were going to be a writer? And how on earth did you end up being this informed, articulate, radical that you are?
Well, thanks. Oh, I've actually been a radical since I was a teenager, pretty much. I haven't calmed down. If anything, I'm probably more radical now. I'm 61 than I ever was. But I wanted to be a writer, yeah, from the time I was. The only other thing I would have wanted to be more would be a Major League Baseball player. That didn't happen. So, but to be a writer is just, you know, to see your name on the, you know, on a book's cover, just know people all over the world are reading it. It's just a fantastic feeling. And it didn't happen for me until I was 50 when my novel, The Unreals, was published. But so it was kind of a delayed dream, but I kept writing all those years, and while I was working and our kids were being raised and coaching sports and so forth, you know, people, I think later, especially the people who had to coach their kids in sports, were a little shocked to realize that this, you know, this kind of laid back nice guy coach had all these incredibly radical opinions. But I've been the way when I was a teenager, I volunteered with Mark Lane Citizens Committee of Inquiry. So I started, you know, I was involved in the Kennedy assassination since then, and the JFK assassination led me down a bunch of other roads, you know, MLK, RFK, and then later all this stuff that's in hidden history, you know, Oklahoma City, Waco, 9/11, obviously, and all the way up until the scandals we see today.
With all of those truths that you were involved in, especially beginning with the assassination of John Kennedy and working with Mark Lane, with all of those things that you were exposed to, why did you choose to write your first work as fiction?
Well, you know, I until really publishers like Skyhorse came out and Trine Day, there's a few of them out there now. The big publishers, I never envisioned that something like Hidden History could be published, to be honest with you. I thought maybe I could write a JFK assassination book, but after the early critics, as you know, Mark Lane had some obviously success with Rush to Judgment, and Sylvia Marr's book, I think, sold pretty well, and Josiah Thompson's The Six Exits in Dallas. So there were some, I guess, bestsellers besides Mark Lane's, but after that, you know, by the time the 70s, when I was first involved in it, people like J. Gary Shaw, who I admire very much, he self-published the book Cover Up, which was a great book. And then David Lifton had a bestseller with Best Evidence. But other than that, it seemed like already that subject was being marginalized and out of the big publishers anyhow. So I thought, like a lot of writers who I admired and read over the years, I mean, going back to Orwell, you know, you can say a lot of things in fiction that you can't say, you know, in nonfiction, because it's, especially if you, like I did with The Unreals, I made it into science fiction. So you can play around a lot there. I like that. I still consider myself primarily a novelist, but I haven't been able to get it. I have a couple other things. I have a novel called The Simulators, I think the best thing I've written. And in fact, Oliver Stone's son, Sean, has it and likes it, and I'd send it to the guy that directed Lawnmower Man. So if anybody's out there, I don't know how long these things take, so I hope, but I can't find a publisher for it. So but the nonfiction came a little easier. I was surprised that Skyhorse went for Hidden History and then Survival of the Richest. So it's gratifying, and I find nonfiction actually easier to write than fiction. So I've got a couple novels on the back burner. I have, you know, Hidden History 2 is out there waiting in the queue, and I have a book about bullying and the school hierarchy that Skyhorse kept for a year and ultimately decided not to publish, to my surprise and disappointment. So I'm looking for a publisher for that. So I have a lot of material, but again, I guess, you know, it's more if you do publish fiction, and I just, there's something more, I guess, special about knowing that your imagination fueled something and inspired people. Not that nonfiction isn't, nonfiction is great too, because you can inform people, but when I envisioned being a writer when I was a child, for instance, I think I thought of being a novelist, you know, primarily.
Do you know that's what Jim Garrison wanted to do more than anything? Jim Garrison wanted to be a writer. Oh, wow. He never wanted to be a lawyer. And you said something truly interesting. You said you can put your imagination to work if you're writing a work of fiction. Do you know that one of Garrison, I think it was Jim's second book, was a Star Spangled Conspiracy, a work of fiction, in which he describes how they set up Clay Shaw how they set up Lee Harvey Oswald to be the fall guy. I mean, it's a fantastic read and would make a fantastic film. But getting to this book here, Survival of the Richest, I mean, it is filled with so much interesting information. I mean, I wouldn't know where to begin. So I'm going to begin by saying that of the many chapters that you have, there is only one chapter with a person's name attached to it. We would obviously know who that is. Yeah. And in my introduction, I said America was not always this way. And you point that out perfectly in this chapter. And that chapter is called Huey Long. Tell us about Huey Long.
Boy, Huey Long has always been, and again, from the time I was a child, I didn't really realize I was being radical, but when I heard the little bit I heard about him as a child, it just kind of excited me. He seemed so different, and later when I would watch, and I was a little more politically sophisticated, I started realizing, boy, how different this guy was. I looked a little bit into his assassination, which, as you know, I cover a little bit in the book, and obviously there's a lot of questions about that. I don't believe the official story for that at all. I don't think it was, you know, young doctor that was upset, you know, over his father being one of Long's many political enemies. But Huey Long, he doesn't get the credit he deserves. In fact, he was a real threat to the establishment. Back in the 30s, you had real leftists. And I'm not talking about FDR. FDR was would have been considered a Bill Clinton or Obama type that kind of was considered a liberal, but he wasn't a Huey Long. And Huey Long, that's why he turned against the New Deal very early on, because he recognized he had all the quotes that you see people saying about Trump today with Goldman Sachs. And he talked about all the bankers and Bernard Baruch and all the people that were around him. And in fact, all his critics on the left did. People don't realize that much of FDR's criticism came from the left and not the right. And Huey Long's pressure from the left, people don't realize that at that time, Huey Long was advocating a 30-hour, perhaps 20-hour work week. He wanted all workers to have 3 months off a year. Now, after he was killed, eventually, a very important piece of legislation, in my mind, the greatest achievement of the New Deal, and I don't think there was much good about the New Deal, but a very important piece came out, and that was the National Labor Relations Act of 1938. That gave us the 40-hour work week. It gave us the concept of overtime. For the first time in history, at least in modern history, working-class Americans were able to take vacations and call in sick if they were and so forth. They had pensions. All of that really resulted from the National Labor Relations Act of 1938, and it came because Huey Long and critics like him wanted even more. And now we see efforts to try to demolish what's left of that. You know, a while back they talked about eliminating the concept of overtime. We see going farther back, efforts to bring back child labor and debtors' prisons and awful things that are going on. Huey Long would be mortified if he saw what was happening, but people don't realize how important he was. And when he died, and I cover all that, the reaction to his death in the book from the New York Times,
But before that, you laid the groundwork really well about why the establishment would want to get rid of Huey Long. Tell us how old he was when he became governor, and then he took on Standard Oil. Nobody would take on oil in America.
Yeah, well, Huey was a boy wonder from an incredibly young age, and he was famously said when he was a very young lawyer, I promise never to take a case against a poor man, and he never did. And he always set his enemies the highest levels. He went against Standard Oil, which ran that ran that state. And he was a very young governor. He was a very young senator. He was only, I think he was 40 when he was, maybe 42 when he was assassinated. So very, if that.
So he was 35 when he was elected. Tell us also, not only what he said about the poor, about the sick, about education, and about right. blacks.
Yeah, well, unlike almost all Southern politicians of his day, he never played racial politics. Well, I love him so much. I hate identity politics. Huey Long is beloved to this day by blacks and whites alike, poor people, because he was for the poor. He wasn't for the blacks or for the Hispanics or whatever. He didn't play racial politics or identity politics. He talked about the important thing, class. It doesn't matter what color you are. If you're getting a raw deal in life, then Huey Long was going to fight for you. He fought for the little guy, not just some different types of little guys. And he was, as you mentioned, about the sick and so forth. Before Huey Long came along, prisoners didn't receive regular medical care. There was no such thing as mental health care for prisoners. Huey Long invented the concept of adult education. He invented free textbooks for school children. He paved the entire state. And as I quote the statistics from the great website that is run by Huey Long's great granddaughter, who I've been lucky enough to talk to several times on the phone, and she likes the book and everything, and I put something about her in the acknowledgments of the book, and it's very gratifying to meet a direct descendant of my political hero. But she has the actual concrete evidence in there, the finite amount that Huey Long saved every household in utility bills. He stopped foreclosures. Almost no one paid property taxes under Huey Long, except the very, very wealthy. So when we talk about like a Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program, I don't know how many households after that was passed within a year could say, wow, we're really benefiting from this. Whereas in Louisiana, poor people especially, they could sit there and they could look at their utility bills. They could look at their property tax bills, which were apparently nothing, if you believe, and say, wow, this man really did something that dramatically impacted our lives. And that's why
Donald, when he decided to run for president, what was his economic platform called?
I'll share the wealth. Share the wealth. Son, he had up to 10 million members at the time of his death. It was a movement that was sweeping the country. And people don't realize that when they call him a communist or socialist, under his plan, keep in mind, this is the mid-1930s, he would have exempted the first $1 million of income from taxation. That would be like, what, $50 million today? So nobody was going to pay taxes under Huey Long's plan except for the really, really wealthy, the 1% of the 1%. And there was a very good reason for that. Huey Long recognized even then where the money was. And he realized that the only way to get that to not trickle down, but to have it be distributed correctly, is not by some kind of plan that you can have loopholes around. He was going after wealth, not just income, but wealth. And he wasn't going to go after, like so many people I talk to think, they're making $200,000 a year, they're going to come after my wealth. No, Huey Long wasn't going to come after your wealth if you made $1 million in the 1930s. But so he really, there's a lot of distortions about what his record was. And it's really appalling
Donald, the surprising thing to me was that you point out in Survival of the Richest, was that so many more on the left seem to be anti-Huey Long than those on the right. What shocked me was to hear that Izzy Stone, was glad when Huey Long was killed. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, you got to watch the Ken Burns documentary sometimes. He's on that a lot, as is Hodding Carter, who was Jimmy Carter's press secretary, his mother, because Hodding Carter, Jimmy Carter's press secretary, another guy who didn't build it, which is the original title of my book. His father was a powerful newspaper publisher in Louisiana and one of Huey Long's greatest political enemies. And I have the quotes in there. Hodding Carter, again, the father, made some basically allusions to Trump being, I mean, to Trump, to Long being assassinated back then. And this was because, as his widow said in that Ken Burns documentary, and I.F. Stone said, they used to discuss it all the time. Mrs. Carter said, we used to meet every Saturday night and said, who's going to kill the SOB? And this is the reality of it. And you sent an I.F. Stone, who is, again, one of those leftists that I believe not even a Noam Chomsky type, but that sort where he is wrong on all the most important.
He was. I used to subscribe to the I.F. Stone Weekly. And he was like Noam Chomsky. He was a very brilliant observer of America's foreign policy, as is Chomsky. Right. But when you get to the question of John Kennedy's assassination, as you can see and hear in the American media in the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy, Noam Chomsky says, who cares who shot him? Nobody cares. I mean, it is totally shocking how you can avoid that. And he's supposed to be this foreign policy expert, and that was the greatest foreign policy disaster. Now, how long after Long announced his run for the presidency was he shot?
Well, he didn't official. I don't believe he had an official announcement, but he was killed in 1935, and he was planning to run in 1936. And you can still look in the congressional record, and his speeches are still there talking about how he was going to be assassinated. He didn't, you know, directly blame Roosevelt or finger Roosevelt, but the obvious inference there was that the powers that be, and Roosevelt was terrified of him, because at the very least he would have made it impossible for Roosevelt to be reelected, because he would have taken support.
Then the other person that we have to talk about who seemed to make an enormous impact in America was Eugene Debs. Tell us about Eugene Debs.
Oh, Eugene Debs is another guy. This is a kind of a socialist who really walk the walk, and that's what I like about Huey Long. I like people that walk the walk and not just talk the talk. Eugene Debs was anti-war, period. He didn't care who we were fighting. He recognized what wars were, and I don't remember it off the top of my head, but I have a great quote from him where he really distilled socialism into like a profound quote where he said, I'm objecting to a system that allows one man to accumulate more wealth and, you know, thousands of people accumulate during an entire working life, something like that. The people that can read the exact epigram at the beginning of one of the chapters in the book. He, as you know, when he opposed, many people did, were thrown in jail for opposing World War II. And he served, I believe, a couple of years, and he wasn't released until, I believe, Harding released him. Woodrow Wilson certainly didn't. And, you know, Debs, he's not a hero in my mind as much as Huey Long, just because I studied Long a lot more. But Debs would be one of those leftists I'd talk about that was the real deal. You know, he was anti-war. He didn't care. He was not going to be, okay, I hate communists. I mean, I love, I'm okay with not fighting communists, but we have to fight the Nazis, that kind of thing. And I think that too many people on the left were that way. And, you know,
Let's leapfrog then, because both of them, I know that Huey Long would have wanted to put a cap on how many millions of dollars a single person could earn, the same with a corporation. So now let's leapfrog now, because we're talking about excessive wealth. Tell us some of the ways that some of the rich and the CEOs of some of the companies and the names of the companies and the people you mentioned in Survival of the Richest. Tell us a few examples of how some of these people fritter away their millions.
Well, what's incredible is that I have a whole chapter on part-time jobs, for instance, how people like Al Gore they get pocket change from sitting on the board. They reward each other by sitting on each other's boards of directors. So Al Gore, for instance, is paid $633,000 a year at last report from Apple for attending 5 meetings a year. And yet this will be the same kind of corporate mentality that will counsel employees, you know, you'll be fired if we catch you taking pens home, or, you know, don't, that kind of thing, where they're concerned about that, or we have to cut down, you know, we can't have a holiday meal at work this year because we're cutting costs, but we can pay those kind of things. And of course, we know the CEOs are paid no matter if they fail or succeed. And in some cases, they're paid more if they fail. Carly Fiorina, for instance, was given a $40 million golden umbrella by Hewlett Packard after running it into the ground. And she had run a company before that into the ground. And yet she felt empowered enough by this rigged system in which she had proven to be, and again, I don't mean just to pick on her, but she's you know, symptomatic of the system.
You pick on a lot of people. How about picking on Welch at General Electric? How much did he get?
Oh God, was that 500, 600 million or something? It was outrageous. And looking at what his compensation package was, I talk about getting freebies. Not only do these people get incredible amounts of money, but they make it so that they really don't even, out of all those hundreds of millions of dollars they're getting, they don't have to pay for their entertainment and everything else. They're given, you know, season's tickets to the Knicks or the Yankees or whatever team they're rooting for. You know, best seats in the house, of course. They're given country club memberships. They're get that kind of stuff that the average riffraff can't afford and would love to. You know, even if you were making a relatively modest salary to get seats for, you know, blue collar fans to get season tickets to your favorite team, that'd be a wonderful perk and be worth a lot of money, because most of these sports and entertainment have been
Welch, as you point out, was the CEO of General Electric. He got that massive, nearly $500 million. Golden parachute, and GE paid no taxes many years.
Yeah. Well, so they said maybe he was worth it, as I pointed out in the book, because he somehow managed to steer the company into a direction where they paid no taxes. And that's the kind of stuff that amazes me. And it goes to the point where, but the average person, if you tell them that, they give you a blank look. If you say, you know, how did somebody get $600 million golden parachute or whatever it was that Welch got, and yet his company paid no taxes that year? You know, huge corporation that could afford to pay him off like that for years of loyal service, and yet they'll give you a blank look. But if you bring up food stamps or how much somebody's getting on welfare, which is a pittance, they'll be ready to fight over that. And that's what they've done. They've channeled the average person. And again, this is, we're talking about lower middle class or even the working poor themselves. They are looking in the wrong direction. They'll be upset. They'll be watching what somebody's buying with their EBT card in the store. But if you talk about the sports team and why they're you know, basically blackmailing the public into financing their stadium so they don't move the team, they're not concerned with that kind of corporate welfare, which amounts to billions, whereas you're talking about a pittance that anybody's getting. Whatever welfare fraud there is nothing compared to just the regular corporate welfare that goes on.
Well, when the corporations get it, I mean, there's socialism for corporations in America. It's called incentives or bailouts. But when they try to rescue the poor, it's called welfare or a handout. Right. One of the things that moved me, it didn't surprise me, but it moved me because I am a huge film buff, having been a critic for all of those years. And I grew up watching Frank Capra. And I perked up when I started to read about, you're talking about the old Jimmy Stewart film, Mr. Deeds Goes to Washington. Tell the folks about what happened. What was the premise of the original Jimmy Stewart, Frank Capra movie? And what happened with Adam Sandler's version?
Well, in the original, it was actually Gary Cooper as Mr. Deeds Goes to Town.
That's,
and it was
right,
It was the first of what I call Capra's populist quartet. That was Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Meet John Doe, and It's a Wonderful Life. My four favorite films of all time. And I was very much inspired by Capra, who I believe was a genuine populist as well. And you can see it in his films. But in the original Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, again, this was during the midst of the Depression. I think it was made in 1936. Gary Cooper plays just kind of an average guy from a small town who inherits a huge fortune.
Is Barbara Stanwyck also in that film?
No, she was in Meet John Doe. Gene Arthur.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, Gene Arthur was great in those films. And so he inherits his fortune, and he's just this hokey guy, and he, you know, everybody's coming around him and stuff, and the press, Gene Arthur plays a reporter who pretends to fall for him, and of course he falls for her, and she's really just trying to get a story to make him look like a, you know, this hokey hillbilly guy and all the crazy stuff he does that the urbane New Yorkers are going to make fun of. Well, what happens is he gets disillusioned and decides to give away his fortune because he starts seeing all the poor. They come to his house and start, you know, saying, hey, could, you know, basically asking for handouts. Well, he decides, hey, you know, I'm just going to divest myself of the fortune. And he's disillusioned with the way he's been treated. So, of course, they declare him insane. They have a trial, which is a highlight. They have a hearing, which is a highlight of the film. And, he ends up, you know, showing how they're crazy and not him. And it's a very uplifting film with a typical Capra upbeat ending. In the remake, though, I mean, Adam Sandler, of all people, who is certainly no Gary Cooper by any margin, in anyone's, you know, definition. But they turned it into this thing where I couldn't even recognize it. I was so disappointed. I watched it, and there's no mention at all of giving the money away. Nothing, which is the central premise of Mr. D's. And it's like, it's just this kind of stupid love story, and I don't even remember, but I just remember, how can they possibly leave that out? I mean, how do you, again, that's the entire premise of the film. But I think that even in so-called liberal Hollywood, like when people say things are liberal, they're liberal in terms of the, you know, some cultural social justice warrior type of things. But as far as redistribution of wealth or something like that dramatic, where somebody with that kind of wealth is going to give it away, well, that that may make some of those Hollywood personalities feel guilty about the wealth they have, because they're certainly not going to be willing to give theirs away. So I think that's why they steered away from that premise, because the public might get an idea, hey, you know.
What? Okay, I have one of two last questions, Donald. Well, actually, I'm going to have three questions, but one is, it's football season, I guess it's in its second week now. Why is it that the National Football League pays no taxes?
Yeah, they're not for profit. They're non-profit. It's amazing, isn't it? And there's so much of our society. Obviously, the NFL is the perhaps the biggest example of that. But and I, as you know, I have a lot in the book about that. But that's, and again, the public doesn't seem to care. There are no protests. And certainly when you get into something like football, I mean, the NFL is America's religion, practically. And, you know, so many people are addicted to it, and it means so much to them. That's why they're able to extort these billions from taxpayers to threaten, when they threaten to move their team away. No, 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 you can't do that. Give them what they want, you know, basically a hold up. But so it doesn't surprise me that no one protests about this. You have a few, like I mentioned, in the, a couple of senators that have protested about it. But that's never going to go anywhere, because, again, affluence means influence. And it doesn't matter whether it's the sporting part of the business world or any other part of the corporate world. When you're talking about people that are billionaires, which almost all NFL owners are, probably all of them are, it doesn't matter. They're going to have power over elected representatives no matter what they do. And so something like this, if they want to claim they're nonprofit, you're going to have some renegade billionaires also to come along and try to fight that, because the public's never going to be able to do that. And it's of course, it's ridiculous. And everybody just kind of laughs when they say they're nonprofit.
And then also, if they're nonprofit, how do you protest against the federal government, the Pentagon, paying $9 million a year to the NFL to have soldiers marching out on the field before every game? I find that highly offensive.
Oh, it's just pure propaganda. And I before I even knew that they were, it wasn't until a couple of years ago, I think the story broke that officially, that we knew that they were actually being paid taxpayer money. But I always thought it was ridiculous, these overt displays of military, which I've been following sports all my life. I don't know if you have or not, but I mean, back in the, I started watching in the 60s, certainly the 60s and 70s. I never remember this type of military presence before these games, but it's such a big production now, especially since 9/11. And it's just part of the overriding flag waving military thing that we see, which is odd, because they combine that kind of thing with the social justice warrior thing. So you almost end up with all the players wearing the pink stuff for breast cancer awareness next to all the military. And that's the kind of a composition we have out there now. And the public's kind of caught in between.
Well, I must tell you, you've written an absolutely fabulous book. It's called Survival of the Richest. So tell people where they can get it. Tell them where they can listen to you next time. And I would love you to come back in about 4 or 5 weeks. I only do the show every other Monday, but I'd love you to come back again, because you are so immensely interested and so enthusiastic and articulate about the things that you are interested in. So where can they get it?
Well, they can get it everywhere. I mean, it's obviously on Amazon. I believe it's in all the Barnes & Noble stores across the country, and probably whatever few books, other bookstores were left. There's not too many of them out there, but I know it's in all the Barnes & Noble stores. You can buy it from the publisher, Skyhorse. I write on my blog regularly about other things if people want to read that. It's called Keeping It Unreal after my novel, The Unreals, and it's donaldjeffries.wordpress.com. I'm easy to find. You know, you can Google. I do lots of interviews. I was on the Conspiracy Show yesterday. I'm going to be on, I hope to be on Coast to Coast again, which I'm on fairly regularly next month, October, I think it's 7th or 8th, I don't know, something. But I'll be promoting that on social media. I do lots of interviews. I'm not hard to find on the internet.
Well, that's wonderful, Donald. Thank you so very, very much. Look forward to having you back again. We're going to be right back with one of the really brightest reporters, writers that I know, the creator of News Vandal, my sidekick, Joe Satilli.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. A tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great VBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on VBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber Live in Las Vegas. That was Donald Jeffrey. The book was Survival of the Richest. It's really a fabulously interesting read. And for me, every day, the one thing that I read every morning is Joe Satilli's News Vandal, and I look forward to talking to him every time he's on my show. He's here again with us right now. And I must say, Joe, again, welcome to the show. And the first four or five articles in your wonderful News Vandal today are about money and about Wall Street.
Well, and this is the interesting thing about your previous guest, Don Jeffries. You know, what he is doing in that book and that you explore with him in your interview is reminding America of its history. And, you know, because of the Cold War and because of the exigencies of evil pinkos and red scares and all the, you know, McCarthyism and everything that happened, you know, America really lost touch with what was going on, the radicalism, the economic radicalism that was present really from the end of World War One all the way through to the coming of World War Two. And it kind of goes all the way back into the 1880s and 1890s as well, because there was definitely a populist economic movement then as well. So, you know, we forget about the Wobblies. We forget about the socialists. We forget about the real jeopardy that capitalism faced in the 1930s when, you know, I'm familiar with one particular professor who was a lefty, an enthusiast of left-wing causes, who despised FDR because he said FDR saved capitalism from himself, from itself. And that's really kind of what FDR did. You know, ironically, he was considered a traitor to his class, which is one of the reasons why the Republicans, particularly the establishment Republicans, have spent the better part of 70 years trying to undo everything that the New Deal did. But really,
the New Deal in reality, Joe, didn't save capitalism. The Depression was saved by the Second World War.
Well, but if it was not for the social safety net and all,
yeah, you're right. You know, and you know what? There are probably a million people over 55 or 60 years of age who are cursing socialists all the way to the bank when they cash their social security checks, and they would not have it had it not been for the socialist platform of Norman Thomas, who was running for president of the United States. And of course, FDR had to steal a lot of those safety nets brought up by the socialists.
Right. And those were the, you know, some people might think marginal, but those were the important clauses that were invested into the economic system that ameliorated the zero-sum game that American capitalism was prior to the crash and the Depression. And so if it was going to be revived, if it was going to persist after World War II, you have to do something to ameliorate the damage that is done in the process of pursuing nothing other than the profit motive. And that actually lasted for a long, long time. As you know, John, you watched it throughout your whole life. And it really wasn't until Carter and stagflation and then the coming of Reagan when it was all bottoming out and people thought it bottomed out. Why? Because government's too involved in the economy. Maybe it's bottoming out because the United States misallocated billions of dollars and millions of lives in the Vietnam War and never recovered economically from it.
You have in your first five stories Wall Street mentioned in three of them. Let me mention three of these. You have Wall Street flacks have an increasingly murky presence in the U.S. media. Then you have Obama goes from the White House to Wall Street in less than a year. And then you have this fellow talking about Stephen
Mnuchin.
Is a window into the most corrupt White House in history. And then
also Gary Cohn is giving Goldman Sachs everything it ever wanted from the Trump administration. That's another one. And you know what, you know, John, you and I have spent most of our lives concerned with the military industrial complex. And you mentioned that World War II saved American capitalism. And that's a pretty safe thing to say because there's a lot of empirical evidence to that. And the military-industrial complex really kind of was the premier sort of financial engine in American life, I think, up until the Reagan administration. And in the Reagan administration, because of the massive wave of deregulation, What did we get? We got a crash in 1987. That crash was built on what? Junk bonds and corporate takeovers. Remember, they were called corporate raiders, right? They would go in and they would find a company that was slightly distressed. They would buy it, and then they would immediately fire the workforce. As soon as they fired the workforce, the stock market went, hey, they're cutting costs. It's going to increase profitability. The cost of the price of the stock would go up. Then they could basically sell off all the assets, sell off at the high point on the stock, and make out like bandits. That's the beginning of financialization. And I think now, you know, these stories are really part and parcel of this. You know, Goldman Sachs was a big boogeyman during Trump's campaign. He was always going off on Goldman Sachs. He tacked Ted Cruz's wife for working at Goldman Sachs. He attacked Hillary Clinton for giving speeches to Goldman Sachs, which is what that one story about Obama going from the White House to Wall Street in less than a year is all about. He's now giving, you know, speeches for Wall Street bankers. But now he's got Gary Cohn in charge of his economic policy. He's got Steven Mnuchin as his partner there as Secretary of the Treasury. And actually, Steve Bannon started out as a Wall Street banker for Goldman Sachs. So, you know, these Goldman Sachs has really sort of morphed into an extra governmental agency, much in the way we used to consider the military industrial complex to be sort of an extra governmental agency that guided American policy. Why? Because, John, what do we do? What does America do? America makes war, so that's still there, but we go into debt, and then we take that debt and we turn it into exotic financial instruments, which is another way of saying we turn debt into a commodity that we sell on the open market. That's what financialization is. So it's like you're not even making anything. We're just, oh, you have debt. Let's take all that debt and let's create this special fund of debt. And then we're going to sell people on this fund of debt and sell it like it's a widget when actually all it is a liability. And there was a point at which in the 90s in particular – under Clinton, which was the second wave of deregulations, when debt basically became an asset. And there were credit card companies, they would, you know, like Capital One or whatever, they would issue their quarterly statements. They would say, you know, our profit and revenue is through the roof. But then you'd look at it and you say, wait a minute, no, your debt is through the roof. That you just have a lot of people who are definitely in debt to you, and you're counting that as an asset, but basically you're relying upon Joe Sixpack, who just went out and bought a big screen TV so he can watch the football game, and bought a pony keg on the way and invited all his friends over to show off his big TV. But in the long run, he's not going to be able to afford it, and he may wash out on that debt. But of course, because they have all these guys in and out of the White House and in and out of Treasury Department and the SEC, because the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington, D.C. spins faster than even the one between the Pentagon and the defense industry, they know that if those debts get to a point at which they cannot be paid off, guess what? Uncle Sam will bail them out.
Exactly. I have a kind of a two-part question here, and one is based on the fact you've been talking about Wall Street, but again, one of your articles is that the technology is transitioning America into a cashless society. But last week on Rents, I heard a fairly interesting economist talking about the fact that she felt, it was a woman, that she felt that Trump would eventually be moved to put America back on the gold standard. Do you think that's entirely possible?
I would be amazed if that were to happen. It would be such a shock to the system. And, you know, there are now there's a competing theory. It's called MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, which basically states that the idea that running a deficit as a government is totally irrelevant, that deficit spending is meaningless because money is basically just numbers. And the government at any time could zero out any debt that it has at any point, and it's really irrelevant because you're no longer on the gold standard. I don't think that you can ever get back on the gold standard at this point unless there's a societal collapse, because the transactions that take place at such high speed and take place between entities that benefit from freedom from the gold standard, the vested interests against the gold standard are so great that I just can't ever imagine it happening. Because, you know, when you had a gold standard, you sort of had a sort of a, a break on the financial system. Now that you have these free-floating fiat currencies, you know, you can start, you know, there was a big thing called the LIBOR scandal, which most people don't know. It's kind of complicated. It's about this special overnight rate that's set in London. And a group of banks got together, and they've been basically, for all intents and purposes, convicted. Now, they weren't convicted in a court of law per se. What they did is they admitted a level of guilt, paid billions of dollars in fines to make it go away. But what they were doing was colluding to adjust marginal rates like 0.1%. But in the volumes of foreign exchanges they were making, of trading one currency against another currency exchanges, just a 0.1% sort of collusion amongst all of them, they were all making hundreds of millions of dollars. So, John, why would they want to give that up by having everything locked down by a real value system rooted in gold?
Well, when the system was rooted in gold in the 20s, before they made it they made it illegal to own gold, you could take a dollar piece and you could take it to the bank and you'd get a dollar's worth of gold. But with all the cash that is afloat in America today, there may not be enough gold in Fort Knox to repay that.
Well, that's also entirely likely. And now also you have cryptocurrencies like Ethereum and Bitcoin, where people are basically creating a whole new category of unrooted monetary value.
Joe, what on earth is Bitcoin?
It's really complicated, but basically guys become Bitcoin miners, and through a very complicated technological process that I'm not sure that I completely understand, even though I've read What is Bitcoin about 750 times over the last 3 years. But it's, you know, tech guys are able to create a fungible currency based on their ability to marshal server space. And by doing this, they create value. And Bitcoin has come up to $1,000 per coin. And one of the beauties of Bitcoin is that you're able to trade it electronically. So this is another thing that I think moves against the idea of a gold standard. I actually think what you're going to see more and more of is people getting involved in bartering relationships as they become micro-entrepreneurial, because this is really the new environment where we're not going to have, you know, you're going to get a job at IBM when you're 22. You're going to put on the white shirt and the black tie, the short sleeve shirt, and you'll be there for 40 years. Since that's not happening, and since we're moving into a gig economy, I think you're going to see more and more people getting involved in micro-entrepreneurial relationships with one another, because we're actually moving out of the economy that you and I experienced for most of our lives. And I don't think anybody has really figured out how the next economy is going to work yet. It's kind of a wide open thing. And certainly electronic transactions are going to be a part of that. Look, it's only a matter of time, John, before people start getting a chip embedded into their, right by their thumb so that they could scan it. I mean, I've already seen pilot programs on that. And people are biohacking and they're putting chips in their bodies as kind of a cultural affectation.
Oh my God, how horrifying. How Orwellian is that?
In this
article that you have, though, the technology is transitioning America into a cashless society. Do you think we really will become a cashless society? Oh, no. Because if we are a cashless society, that means almost every human on the planet or in this society will be controlled somehow by the government. It's
right now
there are people who buy silver and they buy jewelry and they buy gold coins, and they can keep it somewhere in a vault or a safety deposit box, and they can run off to Thailand or Australia or someplace like that because they have this excess cash. But if we're a cashless society, you won't be able to move without permission of your government.
Well, or there will be two classes of people. the people who are wedded to the piece of plastic that is continually refilled electronically and the people who actually have the hard assets that allow them to leverage their position and do things that the other people cannot.
Oh, my goodness gracious. But, you know, I must tell you, it's really sad that we are such a consumer society. Yeah. What a terrible thing to be a consumer. Because I must tell you honestly, from all of the people that I've met throughout my entire life, the shallowest people are happiest when they consume. But the smartest people are happiest, Joe, when they create.
Or converse.
Create, converse, or barter. Yeah. And I think what you're saying about barter, you know, I bet there is a monstrous bartering system going on in the United States of which we are totally unaware and kept unaware of. I bet there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people doing barter now happily and creatively and constructively that we don't even hear about.
It's actually starting. There's a thing called the maker movement, and it's the leading edge of this. It's something I wrote, started to write about in a story on the robot economy that's coming. And I think that you hit on it, John. The key to adapting to this next economy and to pursuing your own freedom is to free yourself from the consumptive economy. The consumptive economy is the shackle.
Well, I must tell you, you know, what I like to do right now is I like to rewind and get back to the business of the Frank Capra movies that I grew up on as a kid. And I'll tell you, I've said this to you and the audience many times when I asked Jim Garrison why on earth he felt as if he could take on the federal government once he realized that the Warren Report was a fraud. And he said, John, as a kid, I guess I saw one too many Frank Capra movies. Well, anybody who's ever seen them our age, they're indelible. They never go away. They become a part of you. But as Ben Hecht said, you know, he wrote, we're out of time. Oh, Joe, I have to say goodbye. Tell folks when they're going to see you next. Hear you next.
Two weeks here, and John, make sure they all get to Amazon to get the second assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe. Very, very much. It's only $1.99. It's going absolutely gangbusters on Amazon, and it's called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I want to thank Donald Jeffries, author of Survival of the Richest, and especially my pal and my cohort, Joe Satilli, for his brilliant news vandal. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Goodbye, everyone. As Ed Murray used to say, good night and good luck.
Spark of nature's fire, you're my sweet complete desire, a sunny, 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 I love you.